Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is Tamina Watson, your host of Tamina Talks Immigration. Welcome. This summer, I decided to record a series called Legal Heroes in the Trump Era. I wanted to speak with some of the lawyers who have stepped up beyond their day jobs to make a difference in immigration, civil rights, and much more. I wanted their insights from their work in the last 4 years so we can learn lessons to take into the future, especially as one of the most consequential elections in America lies ahead. The interview series became a book called Legal Heroes in the Trump Era, The Inspired, Expand Your Impact, Change the World. The book can be found on Amazon and other outlets. I hope you will pick it up. Enjoy these interviews. I hope you'll learn a lot. Thank you so much for listening.
Hey, podcast listeners. Be sure to tune into Tamina Talks Immigration, where immigration attorney Tamina Watson discusses the latest on immigration news and issues. She talks to those who have impacted U.S. immigration laws and policies, as well as notable immigrants who have made great contributions. Check out Tamina Talks Immigration to also hear your questions be answered. Subscribe now for the latest on everything and anything immigration.
The Legal Heroes series of interviews were conducted during the summer of 2020. This particular interview was recorded on June 15th. Please keep that in mind as you hear any topical references. Enjoy the show.
Welcome. This is Tamina Talks Immigration, and I want to introduce you to a very dear friend of mine who's been on the show before, and we're going to speak to her about some issues that are very near and dear to my heart. Today's guest is Anila Afzali. She is the Executive Director of MAPS Amen. Welcome, Anila.
Thank you so much, Tamina, for having me. I'm excited to join you.
Thank you again for being on the show, because you have been on the show before, and I'm going to remind people about that after we speak. But today's topic is really about lawyering in the era of Trump, and there is no other shining example than you. Uh-huh. And I want people to know what you've been doing, how you've been doing that, and how people can do more of what you're doing. So I want people to get to know you first. Can you tell people where you were born and where did you grow up and where you're living now?
Sure. So I was actually born in Kabul, Afghanistan. My family escaped when I was 2 years old from the oncoming Russian invasion. And we lived for 3 years in Germany as refugees before immigrating to the United States because my dad's side of the family was here. And then grew up in the Bay Area, California, moved up to Portland, Oregon, lived there, got to finish middle school and high school there in Portland, Oregon, and then continued on to University of Oregon. I'm a proud Duck for college. And I was very blessed to be the first of my family to get to go to college, and then continued on to Harvard Law School for my legal degree, and then chose Seattle as my place that I still call home today.
Wow, you've got quite the history there. And as you mentioned, Kabul and Afghanistan, I see the books in front of me. What was it? The Sun, I forget the name of the book. Do you know which one I'm talking about? The Seven Sons, or I don't know. It will come to me while we're speaking. Okay. But it was very much an image of Afghanistan that was portrayed in this, where there were two little boys and they grow up together and one eventually moves to America, I think.
Are you thinking of Kite Runner?
Yes, Kite Runner. Okay. And A Thousand Splendid Sons.
That's yes. Same author, yes.
Same author, there you go. Well, you know, how did you always want to be a lawyer? You've been through a very interesting childhood and then, you know, where you are in your career. But how did lawyering come into the picture?
Yeah, so I've always had a very strong sense of justice. Even as a little child, I would constantly be asking questions or challenging any notions that I felt were unfair or unjust. And I remember in seventh grade in middle school, when my dad got a speeding ticket even, I was just, and we thought it was based on racial animus rather than any real wrong that he did. And my dad was just going to pay the ticket. I was like, no, Dad, this is America. This is the justice system. And I was very strong in wanting to represent my dad, even in this, you know, for a speeding ticket. And I remember walking into that courthouse that day, and my dad, even then, he was like, let's just pay this and go. And I said, no, Dad, we got to go. And I remember going in there and standing up and wanting to speak for my dad when it came our turn. And the judge there looked at me and he said, are you a lawyer? And I said, no. And I'm, you know, a middle schooler at the time. And I was like, no. And he's like, then sit back down. And I remember that. But I mean, there was instances like that. We had a lot of different mom and pop shops growing up. And I remember doing the business paperwork for my family. And a lot of that involved legalese that looked like a different language, even though it's written in English. In high school, I played a lawyer in a high school play. I was involved with trying to help my sister with the divorce process she was going through. So there was a lot of things in my life that really sort of pointed the way toward a legal degree or becoming a lawyer, but I just never imagined that to even be possible because I was the first in my family to even get to go and get a college degree. That law school just seemed so far off. It was something that I couldn't even dream about at the time, especially because people who looked like me, who came from my background, I didn't even think that was a possibility. So it wasn't until sort of late in my college years when I was persuaded to consider, you know, continuing my education. And that's when I looked at the law and I applied to 18 different law schools. Because even then, once I started thinking about this as a possibility, I didn't really think of it as being real. And I felt like I had to sort of apply to everywhere to even have a shot. So I've always had that drive of being a lawyer, being an advocate for justice, especially. But my path took a little bit longer because of the realities that I was in. It's hard to answer that question because I guess I've always had something that pushed me towards the law, but just didn't know it until later.
Well, what an accomplishment and how proud your family must be. And as a friend, I'm so proud, but what an accomplishment. So congratulations on just, you know, all of that. So you finished law school and then what happened in your legal career up to today? Give us a little summary.
Sure. So I came to Seattle and worked at a law firm there, a large international law firm, Heller Ehrman at the time. And then after, I believe, 3 years there, I decided I needed a break and I wanted to do something, you know, look at my other options. I had just been driving myself so hard that I felt like I needed just a break to breathe and think about the course that I wanted to take my life. So then I took about a 6-month pause and then joined a mid-sized law firm, Stokes Lawrence, and was there and made partner there. And right as I made partner, I decided to go in-house with one of my clients who had been bugging me about joining them in-house and became general counsel, starting and leading the legal department there in-house. So I got to do that. Before all of that, what I did have is during summer in law school, I did do a stint in Pakistan working with Afghan refugees. Because at the time I went into law school, my interest was international human rights. Again, the strong sense of justice and this desire for civil and human rights for all. So that's what I had started doing. And, you know, my path kind of didn't take that route necessarily. And when I was general counsel, what I actually had, and this was in 2012, 2013 timeframe, where I had a spiritual transformation that really inspired me and motivated me to take real action. And I decided to actually leave my legal career and pursue service and knowledge, two things that my faith so strongly emphasizes. So I actually left my legal career in 2013. And since then, I've been doing all kinds of work, mostly advocacy and service work and trying to build bridges of understanding and unity at a time where our country was seemingly becoming more and more divided.
Well, quite a whirlwind. And what, again, another huge accomplishment. You know, you have started something and people, I want you to talk about what you have started. You are the executive director of MAPS Amen. What is that? So people who don't know anything about it can understand a little bit and tell us about the work that is involved with MAPS Amen.
Sure. So AMEN, American Muslim Empowerment Network, it's a vision that I had. So, you know, I had my spiritual transformation. I decided to pursue knowledge and service, and I'm doing all of this. But as I'm doing this, we're seeing a huge growth in the Islamophobia industry. This industry, a network of a small core group of anti-Muslim hate groups that were spreading false information and this false narrative about Islam and Muslims, really trying to divide us for political gain, for profit, and for other reasons. So I'm seeing this happening, and I'm seeing in my own life and my family's life the beautiful impact that Islam, that our faith is having on our individual lives, and how much it's bringing us peace and beauty and joy and unity and just all of these positive traits, but it's contrary to what's being portrayed out there sort of in the rest of the world. And I'm seeing this growing divide. At the same time, for about 3 years up until 2016, I was basically working off of my savings, and I went through all my savings. Yeah, I even borrowed some money from my sister. So I found myself in a position where I was like, okay, I really need to figure out what I'm going to do with my life that's viable. That's actually why I started interviewing for some legal positions. But as this was happening, I myself was saying, you know what? I started having this vision for Amen. I even came up with a name, and the specific focus areas were going to be education, because unfortunately, the majority of our fellow Americans do not personally know a Muslim and do not know much about Islam. So there was a significant need for education. Number two, engagement, coalition building, really getting people to work together to combat things like Islamophobia, xenophobia, racism, anti-Semitism, and other forms of injustice or oppression. Number three, encouragement of media change, really helping change the narrative that mainstream media portrays, because unfortunately, the majority of mainstream media representation of Islam and Muslims is not only negative, but even defamatory. Like, there was one study about the New York Times, which is a relatively liberal paper, and it found that the New York Times, over the course of 25 years, portrayed Islam and Muslims worse than cancer and cocaine. So that's how bad it was. So encouragement of media change was focus number three. And then finally, empowerment. Empowerment of the American Muslim community and getting the community engaged in the issues of our days, and especially being involved when there are issues that affect us. So it isn't just people talking about us without us. So that was sort of the vision that I had, but I'm like, this isn't viable. And that's why I was interviewing with different legal positions at the time. And right around this time is when the leadership of the Muslim Association of Puget Sound, MAPS, they approached me, because I had been volunteering and working with them and doing a lot of interfaith work. So they approached me and asked sort of, what are your future plans? And it was like, oh, funny you should ask. I have this vision. So I shared my vision for Amen. And they actually loved the idea. And they said, do it, but launch it through MAPS. And that's how we launched MAPS Amen at the end of 2016.
Wow. Congratulations. One more accomplishment in our conversation up to now. There are more to come, I'm sure. So that was end of 2016. And so the presidential election was November 2016 as well. What can you remember? It's a bit like that moment where you'll never forget where you were when 9/11 happened. You will never forget some of these profound moments. And the November 2016 election was one of those. Where were you, and what transpired after the election for you?
Yeah, so for me, specifically at the time, I stayed up all night watching the results coming in. And I have to say, honestly, what I had been seeing before then prepared me for a Trump victory, personally. What I had been seeing and hearing and following, and I had sort of mentally prepared myself for that, but it still shocked me in a way that, even though I was mentally prepared for it, it still was emotionally jarring. And it was really jarring because I really had hoped, or expected better. As a nation, in light of many of the allegations against Trump and a lot of different things happening. And I say this not as necessarily a supporter of Hillary Clinton either. So I just want to be clear about that. But it was really a fear or a concern that I had for so many communities, particularly Black and Brown communities, that were going to potentially face the consequences, the very real and negative consequences of a Trump presidency. And we've certainly seen that come to light. And not only at the sort of state sponsored level, but also the message it sends to individuals. And we've seen the repercussions at an individual level as well. So we've seen the increase in hate crimes, for instance, in the days immediately following and even year following the Trump election. And we continue to deal with the repercussions of that and sort of some of the decisions, executive orders and such, that really impact particularly Black and Brown communities in our country. So that's sort of what was happening. But also at this time is when I was coming up with this vision for Amen. And at a personal level, we had our mosque sign, the Muslim Association Puget Sound MAPS, the sign was attacked, horribly attacked. And it was twice in less than a month that it was attacked. The second time was even caught on camera, because after the first incident, we installed a surveillance camera there. So you're seeing somebody come and just like attack. And as you're watching this, like each hit that he was doing against the sign, it was felt very deeply at a personal level, both to me and members of the community. And that's really what hate crimes are intended to do, to send a message to the entire community, not just an individual sign or an individual person. So that was really felt deeply and viscerally. And it was actually that time frame was when we were talking about creating Amen, and me and the MAPS leaders were talking about this, and we actually launched it between those two instances, between the time of the first hate crime against a MAPS sign and the second one. And something beautiful happened between that as well, which is bringing the community together to celebrate the new sign that we had, and we had people put their handprints on there as well. And it was a beautiful unity celebration of the community coming together, standing in solidarity. And that was sort of, it's kind of like a microcosm or a manifestation of what Amen has been, right? It's been like these bad things that keep happening, whether it's the Muslim ban, whether it's decisions around DACA, whether it's, you know, whatever it may be, but then seeing individuals and communities and coalitions build and come together and stand for what's good, stand in solidarity, and really have that powerful repercussion of the beautiful side of even these dark, sometimes dark moments.
That's truly amazing. And what foresight you had. I mean, where I was, and I stayed up all night too, but I was in utter shock because I couldn't believe that the country would do this. And I remember talking to you in advance where you said, I think we're going to lose it. And I was in disbelief and in denial. And I think being prepared for that moment definitely was a propeller for some like you, because it just definitely gave you that edge in getting ready in what needed to happen. So end of November 2016, you get Amen ready. You are now in a position to advocate. Tell us what's been going on since then and now. It's almost, what, 3.5 years?
Yep, 3.5 years. It has been a whirlwind, because as soon as we launched Amen, then we had another attack on our sign in December 2016. And then January was the Women's March. I was a speaker there. And right after that, it was just a onslaught of events, activities, actions, and it has been just nonstop for the past 3.5 years, honestly, with Amen. We've been doing so many different educational events. I've been speaking in so many different venues. I'm tired of hearing myself speak. So
you're an amazing speaker. You're an amazing speaker.
But it has just been education, it has been engagement, the coalition buildings, it has been working with media and trying to get some actual representative coverage of the Muslim community and about Islam. It has really been empowering for the Muslim community to be engaged and involved and have people who are speaking, who are visible, to have people in hijab even, a head covering, be visible at that level. And in some ways, you know, the hijab even became a sign of resistance for a lot of folks. And you see that sort of shown in various art forms and otherwise. So it has just been nonstop. I also joined the governing board of the Faith Action Network and the steering committee of the Washington Immigrant Solidarity Network, WISN, which was also created in the fall of 2016. So that route of working for the, you know, the rights of immigrants in our communities has also been at a whirlwind pace, and we've moved so quickly on trying to do so much. And, you know, at times you feel like it's a fire hose coming at you and you're just trying to survive. And at other times you have these, again, beautiful moments of solidarity, of success, of victories. And I have to say, especially for lawyers, for the legal profession generally, to be engaged at a level that I had not seen before. And we saw it in instances like right after the Muslim ban was announced, the first one, and the flood of people showing up at airports and being involved, and like the work that you did, and also creating Widen and airport lawyers website, and the significant role that lawyers have played has just been so beautiful to see, because it's still my profession. You know, I tell people I'm a recovering attorney, but I still very strongly identify and connect with the legal profession. And a lot of what we are seeing were assaults on our legal profession, as well as other, you know, industries like journalism, as well as sort of my own core values as a human being, as an American, as a immigrant, a woman of color. Like all aspects of my own identity were being challenged, and trying to come up with not just sort of the response of reaction, you know, reaction to what's happening, but trying to give people real actions, concrete steps that they can take to respond to in order to protect, you know, our rights and civil liberties, but also to help promote and build the kind of bridges of understanding and unity that we need while building these movements, you know, the coalitions and the movements, because I firmly believe we need to have the movements in order to hold individuals and institutions accountable. And it's really the people's movement behind the institutions that leads us to any good throughout history or today. And it's been inspiring to see movements, you know, right after Trump was elected with the Women's March. It's beautiful to see the movements today of people sort of showing up and speaking out and protesting the anti-Black brutality and racism that has existed for far too long in our, you know, justice system. So it's been beautiful to see those, but I'm always big on action. Like, how do we direct people's anger into action? How do we transform these moments into sort of movements? And how do we ensure that we are there to love and protect each other? Because that's what my faith teaches. That's what my own, you know, personal values are. That's what we really need as a country right now, is to build those kinds of connections, coalitions, and really work on creating change together.
And you've said that beautifully. I want to follow up on two things. Number one, I want to ask you about, you've mentioned lawyers have stepped up in ways that haven't done before. I want to follow up on that. I also want to talk about the actions that you have created for others. And so let's take them one by one. And so you did say that lawyers have stepped up in ways they haven't done before. What do you think is different and why?
Yeah, I mean, I think honestly, a lot of people, even beyond lawyers, just people in general in our country, were really pushed to action, compelled to act because of what they saw happen. You know, whether it was concern for our elections and democracy in general, whether it was concern for our justice system, whether it was concern for individuals and communities that are directly harmed and impacted by some of the policies, the proposals, and the orders that we were seeing come out of the Trump administration. Specifically, when it came to, for instance, the Muslim ban that I believe is a horrible stain on our country, and it's going to be one of those that in the future, you know, and hopefully very soon, very near future, we apologize for and remove and regret. But I feel like the Muslim ban and then also some of the decisions around immigration and seeing some of the ugly manifestations of it at a very personal human level, where children are being locked in cages, people are being, you know, families are being separated, mothers and fathers are having their children torn away from them, and how that has been pulling at people's heartstrings. Now, I will say that some of those things were also happening before Trump. So I don't want to suggest that this is all brand new. We know, you know, under President Obama, there were deportations at significant levels, higher than we had seen before. And there was a lot of cause for concern and critique even then. I know I was involved in some of that concern and critique. I know others were as well. But I feel like a lot of people weren't as engaged because it wasn't harsh enough for them. It wasn't really in their face in the same way that Trump has come out and sort of he's taken it to the nth level. And we're seeing people just be just taken aback and shocked that this is something that would happen in our country at the levels that we're seeing it. So I think that really shocked people into action. The same way that, you know, we're seeing right now with the George Floyd brutal murder, the public lynching, essentially, that really shocked people into action. And sometimes it takes something like that and a pandemic before that to really open our eyes to something that has been going on for far too long. And I feel like those are both instances, whether it was a Trump election or whether it was the pandemic and the George Floyd murder, that really have inspired people to show up in the streets in a way that they hadn't before, even though we know anti-Blackness, anti-Black racism and police brutality and killings of Black men in particular and other people of color, Black women as well, has existed for far too long. And we also know that some of the policies that were really pushed to a ugly level with President Trump also existed before. But I feel like people needed something to really propel them into action. And those two instances both happened to be what got people to get up and be outraged enough to take action, to show up in the streets, to speak out, and really to look at what institutions we have to respond to what's happening. And this is the role of lawyers, that we have a justice system. We have a legal system. You know, it's far from perfect. I'm the first to say that, but it's still a system that we can use to try to rein in some of the abuses, some of the horrible policies that really are an affront to all of us, or should be an affront to all of us as human beings. And so that's the way that I've seen sort of lawyers, just like everybody else, because they are, lawyers are, you know, individuals as well, and we're part of communities, but really get inspired to act and take action in a way, particularly once we started seeing some wins, some initial victories, like on the Muslim ban or on DACA or otherwise, some, you know, lower court judges did rule against the constitutionality or permissibility of these kinds of actions. And to see those kinds of successes led by lawyers, I think really raised the profile of lawyers generally, and I think inspired more lawyers to want to get involved and understand that they play a critical role. You know, lawyers can not only provide direct representation to so many people who are in need of it, but also just offer advice or even just speak the lingo, be able to understand what's happening and communicate that with people, right? Like I see even now with some of the stuff happening immediately, the role of lawyers with the police brutality right now is significant too, because lawyers understand a consent decree, like the one that the Seattle Police Department has been under. Lawyers understand an inquest process. They will understand some of the, you know, the bail process and the funding and everything else in ways that maybe not every lay people may understand. So we have a significant responsibility to help others understand what these sort of words mean, what its impacts are, and how we can affect change to make sure that we address these issues of injustice.
Well said. You know, I have felt these very things because I feel like the word activism hasn't necessarily been part of our day-to-day language up until 3 years ago, but we were indeed pushed into action. And being pushed into action has led to activism in ways we've not seen before, because these issues that we're dealing with are unprecedented. But lawyers are the key. So I really appreciate that very detailed explanation. Lawyers, as you mentioned, new lawyers have come in and they have also been active in that they're doing pro bono here or, you know, offering advice at different places. But there are a lot of people who are either coming out of school or there are lawyers who are sitting at a table doing transactional work who want to do more. What would you say to them who want to do more but don't really know what to do?
Yeah, I would highly encourage them to absolutely do more. We need more people involved, and they can bring whatever background they have. I mean, they don't have to leave their legal career like I did. There's so much we can do even within our current whatever role we have, whatever capacity or situation we're in, there's always something we can do. And the advice that I have for them, the biggest advice would be to make sure that we educate ourselves and show up and speak out. That's sort of the way that I would summarize my sort of quick advice to folks, is that this is the time for us to show up and be visible, be active, do whatever we can. If we can take on pro bono cases, great. There's so many different training opportunities. I know you, Tamina, with Wyden, you have offered immigration training services for lawyers to get trained in being prepared to respond, for instance, once we get a decision from the Supreme Court on DACA. So people can get trained and they don't have to have knowledge or background necessarily in immigration law in order to be active right now on some of these issues. So getting trained and actually providing sort of pro bono or low bono services is one way. Another way is to just speak out. As I mentioned before, we know the lingo around some of these cases, some of these orders, some of these decisions, some of these processes that are happening right now. So being able to communicate that to people, whether it's through an op-ed, whether it's through, you know, whatever platform we might have, or whether it's even just through our own social media pages or social media platforms that we have, to be able to write about what's happening and share a strong, both explanatory, if that's appropriate, or just show that strong justice aspect, remind people of why this is such a critical justice issue of our day and why more of us need to be getting involved, speaking out, and sort of showing up. And when I say show up, I mean really show up for the efforts that are being led by the most impacted community members. So for instance, on police violence and anti-Black racism, we need to make sure we follow the lead of Black leaders, individuals, and organizations and support those. You know, if nothing else, let's say we don't have the time or the opportunity as lawyers to do representation at a pro bono level or to write or to be involved in other ways, to show up at events or whatever. At the bare minimum, lawyers can support financially some of the organizations that are doing the work on the ground. So, you know, making sure that they are led by the most impacted community members. So on DACA issues, for instance, making sure you follow the lead of undocumented community members and DACA recipients themselves. On combating Islamophobia, make sure you're following the lead of Muslim organizers and organizations, because sometimes what happens is people, they may have the best of intentions, but they can actually do more harm than good. You know, and ultimately it's about our impact, not our intention. And if our intention may be good, but we go out there and say things about, you know, the Muslim community or the Black community or the, you know, undocumented community in a way that the messaging actually reinforces negative stereotypes or the narrative of our opponents in this realm, then that can be really hurtful and harmful rather than helping the cause. So make sure we educate ourselves from the sources, the people most impacted themselves, and follow their lead and listen to the action calls that they issue. And right now there are so many different action calls at a national level, at a state level, at a county level, local level. It is so many different opportunities for action and so many different opportunities for education, because we have all of these trainings right now happening online. So people from the comfort of their own living room can sit and learn about the issue, find out specific action calls from the organizations that are led by those most directly impacted, and then follow through on that action. And that action could be contacting elected officials, it could be signing petitions, it could be raising funds, it could be showing up to events, to protests, it could be doing virtual gatherings or virtual events. There's so many different opportunities and ways for folks to get involved. So if anybody is interested in that, I highly, highly recommend that they do so, because this is not the time to be sitting on the sidelines. This year in particular is such a transformative year. I mean, we are seeing a revolution, an uprising. This is history in the making, and we can't just be on the sidelines, especially as lawyers who are supposed to be advocates for justice.
History in the making. You're so inspiring. I am sure people will want to see what you're doing and how they can help you. How can they contact you? Do you have a website that you can share and other resources that people might want to find you and the work you're doing?
Sure, absolutely. So the website is www.mapsredmond.org/Amen. We also are on Facebook under Maps Amen. So those are both ways to go find out about the work that we're doing, supported, and also specifically to hear about the different action calls that we issue. Our Facebook in particular has, you know, regular action calls and events that people can learn more or sort of attend or show up and show support. So those are all both great ways. We also have a different website called factsoverfear.org, and that was a campaign that we launched earlier this year. It's a nationwide campaign that consists of 5 animated videos, and these videos are really intended to address specifically the myths and misconceptions promoted by the Islamophobia industry, the anti-Muslim hate industry. And we had created these with the intention of really using them specifically this year when it's an election year, because we know, studies show, that anti-Muslim bigotry increases around elections, that oftentimes it is used as a way to scapegoat or gain political points or political leverage. So we expect to see an increase in Islamophobia, and these videos, I hope everybody takes the time. They're only about 3 minutes or so each, I believe. I hope everybody takes the time to watch each of these videos, share them, especially as we get closer to the election. So that's factsoverfear.org. I personally have been off of Facebook, off of social media in light of everything that's been happening. And this has been for a while now, but I do plan to go back so they can look me up individually as well. I'm on Facebook. I'm not cool enough to be on all the other, you know, Instagram and I can't even speak.
You're the coolest. You are the coolest. You don't need to be everywhere. That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for this inspiring discussion, as always. And you're just a shining example of what lawyers can do without lawyering necessarily, because your innate ability is to be a lawyer. And you're using that education and training to be an incredible advocate. Okay. So you are just an example for anybody who wants to say, well, you know, I just don't find this interesting anymore. Just, you know, pushing paper, but there's just so much out there. So thank you for doing everything that you do. And the listeners and viewers may not know this, but Anila speaks at churches and she's spoken at various rallies and she speaks at every single faith organization that you know. And she speaks at legal events and training events. I mean, if you look at her calendar in any given week, I think she can probably just say, these are the 15 places I'm speaking in one week, and they don't correspond with each other. They're just so different. So you are a multi-talented woman, and we are just so grateful that you are within our community speaking up for us. So thank you so much for being you, but thank you also for being on this podcast today and, you know, sharing your story with people so that others can join in this historic year. So thank you, Anila. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tamina, for having me and for everything you do. You know, you yourself are so inspiring. This podcast is just one tiny portion of the incredible work that you do. And people like you continue to inspire me and give me the strength and hope to do the work that I'm doing. So I appreciate the work you've done both individually through Widen and otherwise. And, you know, I tell people this all the time, that as bad as things may be, it is still an amazing time to be alive. Like I said, it's history in the making. We are going to be judged, you know, by history, and I also believe by God, based on what we do and what we don't do during this time. So I really hope nobody stays on the sidelines. Everybody gets involved and figures out the best way that they can contribute to the cause, to the community, and really help create the kind of change that we all so desperately want and need right now.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the kind words, and thank you again for being here. Really appreciate it.
Tamina Talks is brought to you by Watson Immigration Law. Founded in 2009, Watson Immigration Law is one of Seattle's premier immigration firms, specializing in business and investment visas, but offering a wide range of immigration services. If you need assistance with your immigration needs, Watson Immigration Law is ready to help. Just call 206-292-5237 to schedule an appointment. Mention this podcast to receive a 10% discount off your initial consultation fee. Today's episode was produced and edited by Nicole Lockett.